I'm Dr. Leif Tapanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Hey, today's guests are Marshall Ma and Barry Robison from the University of Idaho. Peter, we're talking about tracking tick-borne illnesses throughout the West. Those little ticks.
Yeah.
Gotta love them, don't you?
Did you have to do the nightly tick check when you were kids during the summer?
You know, okay, so I grew up in Ontario, Canada, and though we were in Northern Ontario when I was a kid and I spent a lot of time outside, ticks were not a thing that I had to worry about at all. I never got a tick, never saw a tick, until I moved out to the Western U.S. and in Idaho, spend a lot of time out in the sagebrush country in especially May when it's wet. Wow, I've seen a lot of ticks.
Yeah, my best tick story is when we were kids, I had a tick embedded in my ear deep enough that the mother and father couldn't get it out. So we went to the doctor the next day, and when they removed her, we knew she was a her because she had laid eggs in my ear. So we kind of had to flush those eggs out as well.
That is horrifying. So the scariest movie I've ever seen in my life is the scene in Wrath of Khan when they put the little bug in the guy's ear.
Yeah.
Oh, so you just brought all of that back.
You're welcome. Oh. You're welcome.
Absolutely terrifying. Tell us more about some nature news.
We're going to talk about Lyme disease today.
Okay, good.
So in the United States, in the last 20 years, Lyme disease has tripled in its prevalence in the United States, making it one of the most common infection transmitted to humans from animals.
Right.
And for those who haven't really experienced Lyme disease, it's called by a bacterium that's hanging out in a black-legged tick.
Right.
And it's transferred to us via a bite, and symptoms include fever, headache, fatigue, and a skin rash. And, you know, the classic is that kind of bullseye
right.
rash, which doesn't show up on everyone that's been infected, by the way. And if untreated, that's when it really gets kind of tough. There's chronic Lyme disease where it spreads to your joints, your heart, your nervous system. And so it's not good when you get that. And most people, including myself, prior to today's episode, just assume that the risk of encountering a black-legged tick that's infected with Lyme disease decreases next to zero during the winter. But it doesn't really happen that way. We've got some research being done out of Dalhousie University up there in Canada. And they were looking at ticks for three winters. They're looking at ticks and their activity and their survival rate. And what they found out is if you're an uninfected black-legged tick, you had 50% chance of dying during the winter.
Right.
If you were a black-legged tick who's infected, you had a 21% chance of dying. So survivorship during the winter actually increased if you're carrying
Lyme
disease, yes. And then the other one that they found out is that as our winters are moving along, temperatures really fluctuate.
Sure.
And when the temperatures during a week in the winter would fluctuate, uninfected ticks were active 1 or 2 days during that week. Infected ticks were active up to 4 days or more during the week, and the infected ticks were especially active after the end of a cold spell. So if we're sitting there and it's been nice and chilly and all of a sudden it breaks and we want to go for a hike in the woods, there's a good chance that there might be a black-legged tick that's up and active that has Lyme disease.
Wow. So the threat doesn't really go away.
Doesn't necessarily go away, no.
Wow. And in some cases, their survivorship and activity rate might actually favor a Lyme-bearing tick.
Yeah.
That's not great news,
no,
I suppose,
it's not good.
It's good to be aware of it, right?
Yeah, totally.
Boy, well, we're going to be tackling a bunch about tick-borne illnesses, especially out here in the West. Our trivia question today deals very much with that. What's the most common tick-borne illness here in Idaho? You may know this, you may not know this. When we come back, we're going to talk all about ticks and tick-borne illness spread through the West. Stay tuned.
Get continued access to local news and all the programs you enjoy through the Listen Live link at KISU.org. Or try using your web-connected Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command, Play KISU.
Hey, welcome back from the break. I want to welcome today's guests. We have two today. It's Marshall Ma and Barry Robison. They're both from the University of Idaho. So first off, thanks for joining us today on The Nature of Idaho. I want to have you guys tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do. Maybe we'll start with Marshall.
Hi, everyone. My name is Marshall Ma. I'm a professor of computer science at the University of Idaho. In my research, I work on like something in the between of computer science and georeference data. So natural resources, environmental science, climate change, mineral resources. My focus is on using data science to address those challenges and the needs in those georeference disciplines.
Barry, tell us about yourself.
Yeah, hi, I'm Barry Robison. I trained as an evolutionary biologist and a geneticist. I'm a professor in the Department of Biological Sciences up here at the U of I, and I'm the director of a research institute called the Institute for Interdisciplinary Data Sciences. And a big part of my research program is making science-based video games for sort of education and just for fun.
So we have a science-based video games expertise, and we have geo-referenced data science expertise, and we're going to talk about tick-borne illness. Let's make the connection between those disciplines and then the specifics of tick-borne illness and tracking. Can you help me with that?
First, briefly talk about why we want to do this research. It's about 10 years ago when I was a postdoc. I was working as a team member in a group. People develop a data portal for the U.S. National Climate Change Research Program. And at that time, I came to know, climate change has a huge impact on human health, because human health is like a very important chapter in a report in that program. And after I came to Idaho, I had a chance to meet with people in different disciplines, climate change, natural resource, entomology, and also human health-related research. And then we come to an idea is that, okay, ticks and tick-borne disease, they seem to be a really serious issue now in the eastern part of the United States, especially the Northeast. We know there's a general trend they are moving towards the West. But then for most of the Western states, especially like in Idaho, we still have very limited amounts of reported tick-borne disease, either Lyme disease or Rocky Mountain spotted fever. But we know they probably will increase because we can see the trends, like the tick population and then the reported tick-borne disease. We look back the past 20 years or 30 years, we look at the whole United States, we can see a trend from east to the west. And so this can be a good chance we can do some study and then probably can find the patterns and then we can send out a message to the decision makers and also to the general public, so they can know what to do and then how to avoid to get infected by the ticks and tick-borne disease. That's why in this program, we have researchers from so many different disciplines, including geography, ecology, natural resource, entomology, biology. So it's kind of cross-disciplinary work.
You know, I think we've had a trend in all the episodes that we've ever really done about the scope of our environment and habitat, where you always move into this big blanket and you've got all these expertise and different disciplines coming together to look at the data and manage the data, all in an attempt to help us as the tick-borne diseases move into Idaho and beyond.
Well, it seems like a big problem, and it's not one area of expertise. It's not just like a tick researcher who knows everything about a tick is going to be able to, on their own, be able to tackle a larger scale problem and a medical issue that we're forecasting, I guess, to increase, only get worse here out west, as we've seen it increase in the northeast part of the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, I suspect that you guys always run into this when you're talking about various topics on your show, where many, many, many of the really thorny, difficult, but important problems in this area cannot be solved by just one mind. There's so many factors that you have to have these interdisciplinary teams to manage it all, that you just can't have an expert that knows all the things. If you think about the details they need to know in terms of where are the ticks? Where are the pathogens that might put us at risk? Do they overlap with the ticks? Not to mention the fact that the life history of these ticks, I mean, you know, it's so complicated. There's so many other animals that can serve as vectors in any particular community. Yeah, it gets very complicated very fast, and you need an interdisciplinary team to tackle this kind of stuff.
Can we talk a little bit about that? So I'm thinking of the variables and where the sources of information are that you guys would use to compile and try to understand the variables that are affecting the incidence of tick-borne illness as we're trying to monitor those incidents out west here. What are the sort of factors that come in, and where are the sources of information that you get your data from?
We think climate change is a big driving force for many factors, like in the temperature and also in ecology, including like the tick population, tick species, and also even different pathogens in this tick-borne disease. So we look at data set on several disciplines and also at several different levels, including the federal government level, state government level, and also there are some individual databases built by communities of scientists, and there are also some crowdsourcing websites, even those using social media platforms to collect data set. So just give a few examples. We have the Global Change Information System. That's a data portal built by the US GCIP. It's a US Global Change Research Program. And then another very important data resource we use is the website of CDC, Center for Disease Control. They have a really good data set at the national level for tick population, number of ticks reported, and also the number of different tick-borne diseases reported. And we're also using some scientific community website, for example, FACNet. There's a FACBone Disease Network. They also have a website and also the database. And another one we use is called a VectorBase. They also have this crowdsourcing mycelium-based data set. And then besides this data set directly focus on tick population, tick-borne disease, we also use data set on, for example, on forestry, wildfire, and also land use, land surface. So the data source include NASA, USGS, some state government, like in the Idaho, we also use several data portals built by the University of Idaho and also the state government in Idaho.
There's a lot of streams of information that you're taking in.
Yeah.
Those are like these giant data sets and data portals that are sort of existing. Some of them are focused obviously on ticks and tick-borne diseases, and others are focused on really important variables in this whole system, right? Like climate and temperature, land use. And then there's a bunch of ones that maybe you wouldn't necessarily think about where some team members are collecting original data, you know, in terms of where are the ticks here in Idaho or in the Northwest or wherever, you know, so that we actually have boots on the ground. People are going out and doing those kinds of collections. What is the genetic diversity and genetic structure of those tick populations? What pathogens are around and where are they? And then there's also fun data sets that you might not think of. So one of our collaborating faculty, Dr. Lau, I mean, he's using Google search data, you know, because Google can release data on what are people searching for in a particular region and things like that. And you can actually look and see when in certain regions in Idaho are people searching for things like tick, Lyme disease, that kind of stuff. And he's actually, that data stream, he's tracking that. And that's also a data injection into this whole process.
Yeah, and that totally makes sense, because if all of a sudden you've got a major, you know, what are the symptoms of Lyme disease on your Google, and you've got a very large population, that might be a hint as to saying that there might be someone that's infected there.
Yeah, I mean, and these things do track in the East where Lyme disease is more prevalent, that those searches track with emergency room admissions and things like that. And then don't forget, all of the patterns of tick-borne illness, are a big feature of that is where and when do people interact with the ticks? And that is driven by whether you guys decide to go out hiking or not, and when you decide to do that. So patterns of people's behavior and their interaction with the outdoors is another big feature of all of this system.
If tick-borne illnesses are not at really high numbers yet out west, are you dealing with small numbers that are difficult to predict? Anytime we have small N value, the small number value, any little change can seem very meaningful. And I'm wondering how, especially early on, you deal with that challenge.
One, I would say we're trying to understand the conditions under which this kind of disease ecology can start to thrive in Idaho. We're not using sort of existing Lyme disease incidents in Idaho as any sort of a predictive component of any of the models. Because like you say, it's too rare. There's no signal there yet. So it's really about understanding and building data sets and models related to the ecological and socio-ecological conditions that would facilitate an increase in risk in the West.
Barry, your specialty is in gamification. Maybe there's a better way to state that. You got to help me. How does this plug in to ticks?
That's kind of a fun question. A big piece of proposals like the one that Marshall got funded, where he's leading this whole initiative, is, you know, how do you relate this stuff to the public, right? In terms of education and outreach and those kinds of activities. And so we make science-based video games in our lab, and Marshall approached us with the idea that potentially that could be applied here. But we're not necessarily making a game where it's like, you know, Tick Blaster, the video game, where we're trying to, you know, like it. So what we tried to do is distill the project down to what are the core kind of intellectual components of this project? And what do people, like, say, school kids or whatever, what do people need to understand? How do we build literacy in that area where they might potentially be able to sort of become future researchers in these areas or understand what we're trying to accomplish better? And so in our mind, if you drew a Venn diagram, this project kind of sits at the intersection of three circles. And so one is data science, right, which is Marshall's area of expertise. And another is the biology of the ticks and things like that. And then another one is kind of disease ecology and human health. And so rather than making Tick Blaster the video game, there are better ways to teach people how to protect themselves from ticks than making a video game about it, right? Wear long pants.
Right.
Yep.
What we do now is we make games that help build data literacy, help people understand how we model infectious diseases, help people understand how we do things like field ecology, like what does it take to go out and collect those kinds of data. So that's what we've chosen to do.
Yeah, I can help add on a little bit on that, why we want to develop the game and how we do the outreach. And it's very interesting. When I was discussing the proposal with Barry in our preparation time, we found an interesting diagram on the CDC website. It's the statistics about the reporting Lyme disease in the United States for almost 20 years, between 2000 and 2018 or 2019. And we see a peak, that's the age group for the reporting Lyme disease. The people between age 5 and 15, they're like with the very highest number among all the age groups. And then we see, okay, this can be a really good chance for us based on our research and also our general knowledge about ticks and tick-borne disease. We can develop some games to do the outreach and education. And especially for Idaho, even though we don't have a very large number of reported and also the close by areas, Idaho, Oregon, Washington, and Montana, even we don't have high number of reported tick-borne disease, we can develop the video games to do the outreach. And then the kids in the early years, they can get the knowledge of ticks and the tick-borne disease. And then later they can know how to do a better job to avoid getting infected.
Yeah, I just think about all the real good teachers I had through my academic career made science fun. I think with these games, it's not just strictly, here's a tick, it's got Lyme disease, what do you do? You learn the science behind it. You learn, you know, what requirements you need for these ticks to thrive. You learn how the ticks get, in a sense, to Idaho. They've got to come in somehow. And then the conditions need to be correct for the ticks, the black-legged ticks, to actually exist and thrive. And then you've got to put yourself into a position where you come into contact with those ticks And then, you know, what can you do to prevent it? And I can see this is, you know, it's like a world building game, but you're learning so much science behind it and make it fun. And hopefully our future generations won't have those spikes in Lyme's disease or other tick-borne illnesses as well.
I completely agree with what you're saying. You've you know, really put your finger on it. But, you know, these games are just one tool, right? Mm-hmm. Like the games are not going to alone achieve what you're describing, but they will resonate with some kids and some teachers, right? Like it's about having a bunch of tools in the toolbox for a teacher so that they can decide, well, this one works for this and that kind of thing. So you're absolutely right. But by themselves, the games are not gonna have that effect. It has to be much, much bigger than developing only science-based video games.
So being that this is a relatively new project, things are just kind of in the early development. What do you forecast? What's the time length for this current leg of the project? And what's the timeline where some of these products will be unfolding?
This is a 4-year research project. And we are now exactly in the 4th year for the data products, the algorithms, and also for sure Barry can talk about the game, but I can talk about the data portal. We are building a really big data portal. We're trying to collect, we're actually diving into the published literature and several other data resources, as I mentioned a moment ago, but also we're diving into the published literature, trying to get an overview of all the reported tick-borne disease, including the different types, different pathogens, and then build a data portal with all those information categorized and well organized. So actually in the middle of March, we're going to have our annual meeting, the project meeting. That's a time for us to take a look and release the data portal, because that will be a very important part of our end product of this project. And another big part is, besides the data set, we also develop several algorithms. It's like a data analysis models to see the spatial temporal patterns, space and time patterns of tick migration, and also the distribution of tick-borne disease. We have collaborators not only from Western United States, but also in the East part. So we do have a number of research outputs on that. It's not only about the data set, but also the patterns we find in the data set.
And I think you've mentioned citizen science earlier. Would this portal be where we can enter data as well? If we do, say I get Lyme disease, am I able to go somewhere and enter some of that data to help you guys and your tracking?
Yeah, we have an interface for the general public to contact us. And just several ways, you can just report some information to us. We can help upload the data set to the portal. And if you are really interested and you want to help, you can register a username and then you can do the data upload and then data edit operations just by yourself on the data portal. It's also available.
There's some people working on apps. I mean, there's a variety of these on the market where you can kind of, you know, take pictures of ticks and identify them and upload that information. iNaturalist obviously is the big one for that kind of a thing. I know some of our colleagues at the University of Nevada, Reno, they have these little tubes and notes that they hand, when they go out collecting, they hand them out to hikers and hunters and whomever else they meet in the field. And it's like, if they find ticks, they can put them in the little tube and mail them into the lab. And that helps them kind of with, you know, and they fill out information on where they found it and stuff like that. And that helps them with their genetic analyses and that kind of stuff. This is the kind of project where, you know, stuff rolls out over the course of the project. And after it ends, I mean, one of the main things we're going to be talking about in our annual meeting that Marshall mentioned is sustainability and follow-up. And so we've already gotten additional grants in the game studio as a result of this funding to continue on for certain things. And we have all sorts of other ideas for additional projects that follow up on what we've built here.
And it's a really good service for, you know, folks in our area to, like you said, it's not really predictive or it's not aimed to be predictive, but it's trying to understand how change is occurring within our region. And we know there's a lot of concern, I think, among folks, especially those that are, you know, outside a lot or who work outside, you know, enhanced exposure. And I think we want to have our behaviors set so that we're ready for any changes in tick-borne illness as it comes through the West.
Yeah, and I mean, and keep in mind that, and we're talking about ticks and tick-borne diseases related to human health, but we know that, I mean, some of our colleagues here at the University of Idaho are working on ticks and their impact on moose populations. I mean, these things, yes, we worry about us getting sick, but they affect a lot of the stuff that the people in Idaho care about, right? Like wildlife populations and things like that as well. So, you know, it's good to know
right.
What's out there, what might be coming, the circumstances, you know, what is potentially within our control to mitigate that and what isn't, you know, it's that kind of stuff that we try to think about.
I wanted to come back to our trivia question. So today we were asking, what's the most common tick-borne illness here in Idaho? Can you help us with that?
You're the tick expert, Marshall. You answer.
I think so far the reported tick-borne disease in the state of Idaho is still, the overall number is still very low, but I think it can be a Rocky Mountain spotted fever, the number one, but it can also be Lyme disease because the both are relatively high. The absolute number is low, but they're relatively high.
Yep, there's the potential. Thank you, Marshall, and thank you, Barry, for joining us today. And we really did enjoy this. This is a great example of how you can bring this is across the United States and how you're bringing in all this data to a very worthwhile project. And for those of you who are interested in what's going on, please head over to tickbase.net and start doing some exploration and research. Thank you guys again.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
The Nature of Idaho receives support from listener contributions to KISU-FM. Music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock. Audio of this and all past episodes of The Nature of Idaho can be found at KISU.org from Spotify and other select podcast services. Send your thoughts and suggestions to NOIDKISU@ISU.edu.